Star Wars, Assault at Salonia, by Roger McBride Allen. Hands tied behind his back, Han Solo stumbled as the guard shoved him into the gloomy audience chamber. He realized a moment too late that the floor of the central area was a half meter below the level of the entrance. Moving too fast to stop, he fell over the edge. His shoulder slammed down onto the hard stone floor. Han rolled over onto his side, then levered himself up into a sitting position. The guard stepped back out and slammed the portal shut behind them. Han was alone in the echoing gloom. He looked around, wondering what was next. At least he was out of that cell, that was something. Of course, whatever came next was not likely to be an improvement. In his experience, it was reasonably safe to be filed away in a cell. It was when you were pulled out that the trouble began. Han got himself up onto his feet and looked around. The walls and floors of the place were made of some sort of utilitarian dark gray stresscrete, and there was a dank scent to the air that suggested the windowless chamber was underground. There were four heavy steel doors, one in each side of the chamber, each of them opening out onto the perimeter platform. Anyone who stood on the platforms would be looking down at the central area. It reminded Han of a gladiator's arena, where the victim struggled for survival while providing amusement for the powers that be. The room was completely undecorated except for a not-quite-throne-like chair made of dark wood that sat on the opposite side of the perimeter platform. This was obviously where the big man of Corellia's Human League would sit. And Han had a very good idea of who the big man was going to be. His cousin, Thrakken Sal Solo. Good old murderous, scheming, vindictive, paranoid Thrakken. That was the who, but what was the why? Obviously, they had been keeping him alive for this meeting, but would they have any reason to keep him alive afterwards? After all, Han had blown up half a squadron of pocket patrol boats. That was offense enough to get a fellow executed most places. Nor would his relationship to Thrakken do him any good. Once Thrakken had indulged his curiosity, he would be quite capable of killing Han on the spot. The doors swung fully open, and a double line of seedy-looking men in officers' uniforms came in. One column turned and marched around the corner of the platform to the left of the throne, the other to the right. By the looks of their paunchy guts, none of them had done any real training in years. Their bleary eyes, flushed faces, and unshaven jaws, and the smell of strong drink that wafted in with them, told Han that at least some of these officers had been doing some fairly serious celebrating the night before. Then Thrakken Sal Solo, one-time hidden leader of the Human League, and now the self-declared diktat of the Corellian sector, came into the room. He came forward to the edge of the platform and stared long and hard at his long-lost cousin. Han stared back. He felt as if he were staring into a strange, distorting mirror. Thrakken wore Han's face, or else Han wore his. Not that one could not be told from the other. Thrakken's hair was darker, a black-brown shot through with gray. He was somewhat heavier, and he had a neatly trimmed beard. Thrakken was perhaps 2 or 3 centimeters taller than Han. There was a ruthlessness, not just in Thrakken's expression, but in the set of his face, as if that look of anger and suspicion was the one his face fell into most naturally. But even those differences did little more than emphasize how much they were alike. Han felt as if that imaginary mirror were showing him the man he might have been. He did not like that idea. "Hello, Thrakken. I sort of figured I'd be seeing you."
"And hello to you, Han. Some things never change, do they?
Back in the old days, you were always the one who liked to play games, and I was always the one who had to come in and clean up after you." "That's not exactly the way I remember it."
Strachan had never cleaned up after himself, let alone anyone else, but he had always been good at making it seem like he had. Most bullies were good at playing the victim. But you're right. Some things never change, Han said.
This time there's rather a lot to clean up, Strachan went on. You shot up my spaceport, damaged or destroyed 6 of my pocket patrol boats, and allowed that X-Tai ugly fighter to escape. We believe an X-Tai managed to jump into hyperspace. If its pilot gets word to the New Republic, that could throw many of my plans into disarray.
I have a suggestion, Han said. Let me go, and then let me accept your surrender. I might be able to get the New Republic to go easy on you.
I don't suppose you'd be willing to explain why I should do that.
Because you're going to lose, Thraken. Because that X-Tai got through, and even if it didn't, someone else will get the word out somehow. And you're up against the same New Republic that beat the Empire. If they could take on the Emperor and Darth Vader and Admiral Thrawn and the Death Stars, what makes you think they should have any problems with the likes of you?
Still the same old Han. Full of the same old tired bluster and bluff. There's a very good reason I'm not going to lose. I've won already. The New Republic might be able to cause me some limited trouble, but nothing more. Not unless they want a few inhabited star systems vaporized. Otherwise, they will leave me strictly alone.
Han hesitated a moment before replying. Was there anything behind that claim? There was no doubt that a star had gone supernova, a star that had no business doing any such thing. The Human League had claimed responsibility, but how could a bunch of ignorant malcontents and thugs manage to blow up a star?
Well, that was a nice parlor trick, Han said, but I'm not convinced you can repeat it.
Oh, we'll convince you. Have no doubt of that. So why am I here, Thraken? Han asked, in a tone of voice that made it sound as if he were a busy man who had more important things to do.
I did have a vague idea that you might be willing to cooperate with me, act like a patriotic Corellian, help me get rid of these New Republic interlopers. But it's not going to happen, is it?
Not in a million years.
All right, then. If you won't help me,
why should I keep you alive? Think, Han told himself. It was obvious that the Human League had deliberately timed its uprising to coincide with the trade summit, when Leia Organa Solo and lots of other off-planet movers and shakers would be on Corellia. And all of those brass were staying in the Governor General's residence, Coronet House. If the League had wanted to, it could have blown the building to smithereens, decapitating the planetary government at a stroke and killing the New Republic's chief of state as well. But they had done no such thing. Han had been at Coronet House when the assault came. In his best judgment, it had been a clumsily executed surgical strike, not a bungled decapitation attempt. It was clear that the League had intended to bottle up the Governor General and Leia and the rest of the higher-ups in Coronet House by sealing off all the exits and burying them in rubble. That Han had managed to escape was a testament to their incompetence. It was hard to avoid the notion that Thraken wanted Leia and the others as hostages. Suddenly, Han understood. His cousin was keeping him alive in hopes of using him to ensure Leia's cooperation in whatever plots he was hatching. But if he needed something from Leia, that meant Thraken Salsola was not the master of all he surveyed, all bluster to the contrary. Han grinned.
There's no reason at all to keep me alive, none whatsoever.
At least there isn't, if you don't care how upset the Chief of State gets. And she tends to get real angry when members of her family are murdered in cold blood. Thraken was suddenly furious.
I don't need your chief of state.
Then why did you work so hard to capture her?
Quiet! I'll ask the questions around here. One more word about your wife, and I swear I'll kill you myself.
Han said nothing, knowing that he had won. And Thraken knew it. Han had called his bluff. Thraken kept his eyes squarely on Han as he turned to one of the officers.
Captain Falco, instruct the keepers to send the other prisoner in.
The doors swung open, and a pair of heavily armed Human League troopers came in, their blasters at the ready. They immediately took up positions on either side of the door with their backs to the wall. It would seem beleaguers regarded the whatever it was as far more of a threat than Han. After a moment's pause, the other prisoner came in. And suddenly Han understood all the precautions. The other prisoner
was a Salonian. Even thugs and fools knew to take Salonians very seriously indeed. And this Salonian female was big and tough-looking. Though that was no surprise. All the Salonians ever seen in public were big, tough, and female. She was a trifle taller and more slender than Han. Her short, powerful tail, which helped her propel through water and balance while walking, would make a fearsome club in a fight. The graceful, sleek-furred creature walked into the room casually. With such self-assurance, she might have been the master of the place and not its prisoner. There was one other thing that Han noticed. The Salonian had her hands free. That could only mean that she had promised not to disobey or attempt to escape.
"Get down there, you,"
one of the guards told her, pointing to the lower level of the chamber where Han waited.
"Say hello to Drachmas,"
Thakin said after the Salonian had joined Han. "Quite an impressive specimen, don't you think? She was trying to do us a little damage in Coronet when we picked her up. Drachmas, say hello to the family pirate and traitor, my dear cousin, Han Solo."
"Melorna fa ecto mandabasa, depicto Han Solo," said Drachmas.
Her words did not match the contemptuous tone of her voice.
"Speak you this language of mine, honorable Han Solo? None of these fools do."
Han thought fast. He had no way of knowing what Drachmas intended. All he knew was that she was the enemy of his enemy.
"Bellor naxa mandabafa kursa kurso,"
Han snarled back, trying to make his voice as abusive sounding as Drachmas's had been. "Speak me it well enough," was what he had actually said. Han backed to the corner and risked a glance at Thrakken. His cousin was grinning ear to ear. Clearly, he had no doubt the two of them were trading insults. Drachmas growled at him in Salonian.
"Good. I think they will force us to fight. Allow me to win quickly, and you will avoid being well injured."
"I see there is great love between you," Thrakken said. "I think our Salonian friend has many pent-up feelings for her hosts. She cannot vent them on us, as she has made an oath not to and must not break it. I must say that it is convenient to have an enemy of such strong principles. I think I shall reward her honorable behavior and let her take it all out on you." Han tugged at his bonds, but they held firm. "A nice, fair fight, Thrakken. A Salonian against a human with his hands tied behind his back." Thrakken laughed.
"I'm interested in entertainment, Han, not fairness."
He indicated the four guards, who by this time had positioned themselves in the four corners of the chamber's upper level.
"Shoot,"
said Thrakken.
All four of them aimed their blasters at the center of the chamber's floor and fired simultaneously. The floor exploded in a gout of flame. Han flinched from the blast, his face and hands stung as he was peppered with micro-fragments of pulverized stresscrete.
"And if you do not acquit yourself well, my troopers will fire again. At both of you."
Han's vision had cleared enough now for him to see Drachmas clearly, and it was plain that the Salonian was more than prepared to give a good fight. She had her mouth open, putting her needle-sharp teeth on clear display. The only thing Han had going for him was surprise, and he decided to use it. He shouted at the top of his lungs and charged straight for Drachmas, his head down. He got under her guard, if just barely, and managed to give her a good solid headbutt to the gut. He hit her hard enough to knock down a human, but she managed to use her tail to steady herself against the floor and stay upright. She took a swipe at his head with her left-hand paw. She didn't connect fully, but it was enough to send him sprawling. He recovered and spun to his right just in time to dodge another open-handed slap at his head. And in that split second, Han knew he could trust her, at least part of the way. He saw her claws retract in the instant before her hand paw whipped past his face, and she had missed by less than the length of those claws. Han dodged another swing from the left, but ran straight into the sucker punch to his chest. The blow knocked him clean off his feet. He landed on the hard stresscrete floor, taking most of the fall across the top of his back, although he managed to crush his hands and bounce the back of his head off the stresscrete. Drachmas was lunging for him before he could even begin to recover, and it was either Han's dumb luck or Drachmas's superb reflexes that sent her diving left as he rolled right.
The men on either side of the chamber were hooting and cheering and cursing. He would have to finish it quick and go down fighting, satisfy Thrakken that he had gotten a good show. Han staggered to the right, circling around. Drachmas came no closer, but circled as well, watching for her chance. Han yanked once more at his wrist restraints out of frustration as much as anything else, and was astonished to feel them snap. Either the restraints' locks had been damaged in the fall, or, more likely, Thrakken had put him in gimmicked restraints to start with, something that could be released by remote control at whatever moment seemed most amusing to the operator. It didn't matter. He had his hands. He spread his arms wide in a wrestler's stance and moved in on Drachmas. Drachmas was at least as surprised as Han to realize her opponent suddenly had his hands free. She backpedaled a bit, getting a bit more distance between Han and herself. She might or might not want to kill Han, but she had every intention of beating him. Well, he was going to make her work for it. He feinted to the left once, twice, and then to the right before diving straight in, grasping his hands together in a pile driver punch to the gut. From the expression on her face, it clearly hurt a lot, but it also got a good and mad. Those sharp jaws swung around and snapped down on thin air, a centimeter from Han's arm. And even before he had stopped dodging, an iron-hard fist hit him square in the chest. If it had hit him in the stomach, he would have doubled over in pain. But Drachmas had placed her blow too high. As it was, Han was thrown back down onto the floor. Drachmas's tail was lashing back and forth, and she had her fangs bared. But she did not dive in to get her teeth around his throat or rake her claws across his eyes. She was still restraining herself. Han realized that he had to throw this fight immediately before she lost all control of her anger and moved in for the kill.
"Use your tail!"
he bellowed to her in Salonian.
"Batter me with that!"
The angry light in her eye seemed to dim for a moment, and she looked at him as if she were surprised to see him there. Even though he had urged her to make the move, he didn't even realize she was still swinging around, pivoting on one foot to bring her tail around. She had it raised high and caught Han neatly in the head with it. He was almost glad when the darkness closed over him. The Lady Luck cut her light-speed engines and dropped into normal space in the Coruscant system. Lando Calrissian checked the navicomputer and nodded in satisfaction.
"In the groove," he said. "We've got auto-clearance from Coruscant Control all the way in."
"Good," Luke said. "The sooner we're there, the better."
"Shouldn't we try and contact the Navy brass from here?"
Lando asked.
"We don't want to waste any time."
Luke shook his head. "No, we have to assume that an organization that can seal off the entire Corellian star system is capable of monitoring communications, even on secure links."
"You might be right."
Someone or something had placed an interdiction field around the entire Corellian planetary system, produced by using a gravity well generator to distort the mass lines of real space. No ship inside the field could make the jump to light speed, and any craft that passed through the field while in hyperspace would be forced out into normal space. Luke and Lando had discovered the interdiction field when the Lady Luck was abruptly decanted out of hyperspace on the outskirts of the Corellian system. They had been on their way to meet Han and Leia and their three children, who were taking advantage of a big trade summit to spend some time on Han's home planet. But Lando had other, more personal worries as well. Tendra. Lady Tendra Rezant of the planet Sikoria. Lando had met her just a few days before, but he already knew that she was someone special. Someone who could be important in his life. It was more than a trifle ironic that he had set off across the galaxy in search of someone to marry for money, only to meet a woman who made him forget all about money. Well, at least made him stop thinking about it for a while. What concerned him at the moment was that when he had bid her farewell, he had been bound for Corellia, and she had known it. Sooner or later, probably sooner, Sikoria, along with the rest of the galaxy, would learn that Corellia had cut itself off from the outside universe. She would worry, and would likely do more than that. Tendra was not the sort of person to sit idly by. She would act. And knowing that gave Lando plenty to worry about. And even if she did just sit tight, Tendra had said that things were brewing on Sikoria, one of the outlier planets, so called because it was on the fringes of the Corellian sector, in both physical and political terms.
Sikoria was populated by the same three species as Corellia: human, Drow, and Salonian. It was ruled by the Triad, a mysterious triumvirate made of self-appointed representatives from each of the three species. That right there was enough to give Lando pause. In his experience, shared power dictatorships were not exactly the most rational or stable forms of government. There had been a clampdown in progress when Luke and Lando had been on Sikoria. Enough of a clampdown to get them kicked off the planet. Lando checked his system displays one more time, then looked over to Luke in the co-pilot seat. Luke, do you think that the trouble on Sikoria might have something to do with the Corellian interdiction field? Luke frowned. What makes you think that? Well, one place threw us out, and the other threw up an interdiction field like a wall to keep us out. Come on, the whole interdiction field just to keep us out? I knew you had a big ego, Lando, but let's not get carried away. I'm not that important, but you are. You're the Jedi Master. That's why I brought you along on this trip, so you could impress everybody. Well, maybe the Corellians were impressed. The folks who kicked us off Sikoria could have guessed that's where we were headed, and they could have found out for sure a half dozen ways. Lando hooked a thumb toward the ward room where R2-D2 and C-3PO were. All they'd have to do is set Golden Boy back there to talking, and they'd have our life stories in 30 seconds.
I heard that, and I must deny it. I am always discreet in my dealings with outsiders.
Get off this feed and quit snooping, you blabbermouth collection of spare parts, Lando said.
But I must protest.
There's no need for you to be listening in, 3PO, Luke said. Just tell R2 to get ready for a final approach. We'll be home on Coruscant soon. He reached over and cut the power to the intercom.
I think 3PO just made my point for me, Lando said. If the Sikorians had wanted to find out where we were headed, they could have done it.
No doubt about it, said Luke. But that interdiction field is not the sort of thing you casually switch on just to keep out one unwanted visitor. There are easier ways to keep a person out of a star system, even a Jedi Knight.
I suppose, but even if the Corellian field wasn't activated just to keep us out of the picture, I still think there might be a connection between the clampdown on Sikoria and whatever has happened in the Corellian system.
You might have something, Luke said. But I've got a feeling we're not going to know one way or the other for quite a while yet. The Lady Luck flew on. Luke was more than a little surprised to see the reception committee that was waiting for them on Coruscant as they disembarked from the Lady Luck. The usual landing bay crew was nowhere to be seen, and instead they were greeted by a distinctly closed-mouthed security team of two men and one woman in New Republic intelligence uniforms. The senior NRI officer came forward.
Master Skywalker, Captain Calrissian, good day to you both. I'm Captain Showalter of New Republic intelligence. The two of you are wanted rather urgently at an important meeting. Would you be so kind as to come with us?
They got into an air car that took them to an anonymous shipping dock. Showalter escorted them toward a waiting turbo lift, while the other two NRI officers stayed in the air car. The turbo lift doors shut as soon as they were in, and the car began to descend. Where to? Luke asked.
An NRI safe room, Showalter said. And we're going in by the back door. Doctrine requires that each party come by a separate route, if at all possible. Makes it harder for the opposition to realize that people are getting together.
Luke was trying to judge the descent of the turbolift car. As best he could estimate, they were at least 800 meters below their starting point when the car came to a halt. The door did not open. Instead, Showalter drew his sidearm, a New Republic standard-issue blaster. For a fleeting moment, Luke wondered if they had just walked into a trap. But he sensed no malice or deception on Showalter's part, and the NRI officer's next words set him at ease.
Captain Calrissian, Master Skywalker, I believe you are both armed. Might I suggest you draw your weapons before we open the door?
Sure, Lando said as he drew his own blaster. But mind if I ask why?
Local wildlife, Showalter said.
Oh, my, 3PO said. Feral hunters here?
That's right, Showalter said.
Ah, Luke said. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. The city of Coruscant had been where it was for a long, long time, and any number of strange animals had been brought to the planet. Some of them had been domesticated, some were farmed, and some exhibited. Over the millennia, a certain number of them had escaped, and of those, a fair number had gone feral, and had even evolved to adapt to their new circumstances. There were endless urban legends of underlevel zombies, ferocious creatures descended from hapless tourists or office workers who had gotten lost in the subterranean levels thousands of years in the past.
"So what's the local nuisance in this part of the city?" asked Lando.
"We call them corridor ghouls," Showalter said, "but we're not quite sure what they are. However, they are definitely hungry."
Luke held his lightsaber at the ready but did not switch it on.
"If the corridor ghouls are as nasty as you say, why can't you just sweep them out of this part of the tunnels and then block all the entrances?"
Showalter laughed unpleasantly.
"I see. I haven't made myself clear. We like having them around. They're part of the security system. So if you don't need to shoot one, please don't."
The chamber was dimly lit, the only illumination coming from ceiling glow tubes in a tunnel that opened out in the chamber wall directly opposite the turbo lift. Showalter led the way toward the tunnel at a brisk pace, his blaster at the ready. But then, suddenly, just as Showalter was coming to the first intersection in the tunnel and making the first left, Luke sensed the ghouls. And at that moment, they started to scream. Luke reminded himself that it was a hunting cry, nothing more, a call from one predator to another. But even so, the sound made his blood turn cold. And there they were, three of them, standing at the tunnel entrance. They were about a meter high at the shoulder, their furless, dead-white bodies lean and wiry. They were long-legged and clearly made for running and jumping. Their ears were huge and pointed and were constantly swiveling back and forth, independent of each other, as if they were tuning in on each sound in turn. Their eyeless heads had long muzzles, their noses twitching constantly. Luke estimated that their sense of smell was as good as their hearing. The three of them were just standing there with their mouths open, making no sound at all that Luke could hear. He called over his shoulder at the droids.
3PO, R2, can you hear anything in ultrasonic?
Why, yes, of course, Master Luke. The sound appears to be coming from the ghouls directly ahead of you. It is similar to the screams we just heard, but at a far higher frequency. Good heavens! R2 reports they are directing beamed ultrasonics at each of us in turn. He suggests they are probing our internal structures in order to decide which of us might be good to eat.
Relax there, 3PO,
Luke said.
I doubt they'll find much good eating on a metal android.
Why, that's true. That's a great comfort.
Glad to hear it. Lando, Captain Showalter?
He called without looking behind him.
What's going on? We can't see them or hear them, but they're still there somewhere. Hold on a moment,
Luke said. He reached out with his power in the Force and felt for the minds of the creatures in front of him. They were clever little minds, sharp and quick and direct. Subtle tricks or indirection wouldn't work here. Well, sometimes the simplest ways were best. Luke found the proper spots in their minds and struck them with a jolt of pure terror. They were gone almost before he was aware they had moved at all, and he relaxed his guard, if only a trifle.
You wait here and watch my back, he told Showalter. I want to try something.
Showalter looked as if he wanted to protest, but he kept his mouth shut. Luke moved past him, took a left turn in the corridor, and then the next left. The tunnel immediately started heading down at a pretty fair incline. He unclipped his lightsaber and switched it on. The glow of its blade added an eerie secondary illumination to the corridor. He came to the bottom of the ramp, where it opened into a wide corridor. There they were, directly in front of the blast door Showalter had told them they had to enter. Three of the eyeless creatures, ghost-white, open-mouthed, their sharp teeth at the ready. It was clear they saw Lou through their echolocation sense. Easy now. Luke sidled to the right of the ramp entrance, trying to put as much of a soothing tone into his voice as he could manage.
But the minds of these creatures weren't interested in being soothed.
How could they be when they had evolved somehow to survive in the miserable, eat-or-be-eaten darkness of Coruscant's undercity? Luke noticed a few scattered bones on the floor and recognized one of them as teeth in a jawbone that came from a ghoul. This place was dangerous to them. No, there was no hope of calming these creatures down. A Jedi did not meddle in any living being's mind capriciously, only at need. And now there was need. Luke willed the creatures to move away from the blast door toward the rubble pile, and they moved that way stiff-leggedly and awkwardly. He forced them toward the farthest corner of the lower chamber and held them there.
Captain Showalter? Lando, I have the way open, but I need you down here on the double.
Coming!
Lando called, and Luke could hear the sounds of the two men and the droids moving down the corridor toward him. The ghouls Luke had immobilized immediately began to strain harder at the invisible bonds that held them. They yelped and moaned and snapped their jaws. Luke could hear Showalter punching a code into the blast door keypad, and a moment later he heard the door itself start to swing open. Just as he stepped toward the entrance, the other pack of ghouls appeared at the base of the ramp, screaming, ululating, their ears pivoting and twitching as they divided their attention between their immobilized comrades and the open blast door. Luke did not wait to see the end of the drama, but backed through the door, his lightsaber still at the ready. Lando hit the slap switch and the blast door slammed shut. Luke released his control of the ghouls. In less time than he would have thought possible, he could hear them leaping for the blast door, howling and keening, their clawed feet clattering and clicking on the door's durasteel exterior. The blast door opened into a sort of airlock chamber about 4 meters long, with another one at the far end. Showalter used the keypad on the second door, and it swung open to reveal a well-appointed L-shaped conference room.
"I might have known you'd be the one to get here the hard way,"
a familiar gravelly voice said from around the corner.
"Admiral Akbar," Luke cried out. "Good to see you again."
"It would be better if you were seeing him again under somewhat more pleasant circumstances."
"Mon Mothma," said Luke.
"It's good to see you as well under any circumstances." Mon Mothma had a slight smile on her lips. "I see that you took my advice and went traveling with my good friend Lando Calrissian. Tell me, Captain Calrissian, was your trip profitable?"
"Very definitely, yes, Mon Mothma. Personally, that is, not financially. We were forced to cut it short, though, before we got as far as Corellia."
Lando began to fill them in about the interdiction field.
"That's impossible," Akbar said. "No one has ever managed to generate a field that large."
"That's exactly what I thought," Lando replied. "But I can tell you, it's there."
Luke looked to Akbar and Mon Mothma. "Wait a second. If you don't know about the interdiction field, why are we here?" "It's very simple," Mon Mothma said. "We have lost all, and I repeat all, communication with the Corellian planetary system." Lando let out a low whistle.
"Wow.
But you have something else that's got you worried," Luke said. "Otherwise, we wouldn't be meeting underground." "Quite right, Captain Showalter."
"Thank you, ma'am."
Showalter turned to address Luke and Lando. "Even before the communications blackout, we were concerned that someone in the Corellian planetary system had managed to penetrate our communications. We kept sending agents into the system, and they kept vanishing. The more carefully we planned the penetration, the faster we lost the agent. There has to be some sort of tap or betrayal outside the Corellian system." "Therefore," said Mon Mothma, "we have decided that all business related to this situation must be dealt with face-to-face in secure facilities at covert meetings."
"We have also decided we're going to have to go in."
Admiral Akbar's voice was gruff even for him.
"I don't see any real way around it. Unfortunately, nearly all of our ships are committed elsewhere or in dry dock. I don't think that's a coincidence. But leave that to one side for the moment. What more do you know about the interdiction field?"
Luke turned to his astromech droid. R2? R2 rolled over to stand next to Luke's chair. "Show the graphic images on the interdiction field." R2 projected a standard wireframe schematic diagram of the Corellian planetary system, showing the star Corel, the planet Corellia, and the other inhabited planets, Salonia, Dral, and the double worlds of Tralis and Talus, along with the outer planets. After a few moments, a hazy gray cloud appeared around all of it, a sphere that extended far beyond the outermost planet of the system.
"It's not centered on the star Corella,"
Akbar said at once.
"Very good, Admiral. It took us the better part of a day to notice that. But you're right, it isn't. As best we can tell, it seems to be centered somewhere in the vicinity of Talus and Tralis, the double worlds. They're called the double worlds because they orbit about each other, or more accurately, about their common center of gravity, or barycenter. And, of course, the system of the two planets is in orbit around Corell as well.
There's some sort of big space station in the barycenter point, isn't there? One that might make a base of operations."
Luke smiled at his old friend. "So there is. Already thinking tactics?"
"Of course. That's my job, after all. And I might add that our imagery of the jamming looks very similar to this display of the interdiction field."
"So," Luke said, "we've got the infiltration of NRI, the jamming, and the giant interdiction field. What in the Corellian system is worth going to all this effort?"
"I should think that was obvious," Mon Mothma said. "The Corellian system itself. Someone in there, one of the rebel groups, has seized power and has done everything possible to keep the outside universe from interfering while it consolidates its position."
"Quite right," Admiral Akbar said. "And what they have done suggests that our mysterious enemies have technology far superior to ours."
"I agree, sir," said Captain Showalter. "But that brings up another question. Where did they get it? Corellia used to be known as a trading center, not a hotbed of high technology."
"Yes, obviously, if someone is going to try and sell a superweapon like this to the highest bidder, a trading planet would be the place to try. But it's been 10 years since Corellia was a major player in interstellar trade. If I were trying to auction off a wonder weapon, I wouldn't sell it to a planet that's strapped for cash."
"Unless you consider that the better-off planets might not be interested in buying such a device," Mon Mothma said. "High-power jamming and interdiction systems aren't of much use unless you want to keep the outside universe and the New Republic from interfering in your plans. Plans for a rebellion, for example. And what is to stop the sellers from offering their wares elsewhere?" There was a moment's dead silence.
"That is a most disturbing thought," Akbar said at last. "A successful Corellian rebellion could be the beginning of the end for the New Republic."
"As unhappy as I am to admit it, Admiral Akbar is quite right. We must get the situation under control. We must get into the Corellian system and find out what is going on."
"There is, of course, the trifling matter of finding a battle fleet. To put it very bluntly, we don't have one at the moment, and it could easily take us months to assemble one. But that is the reason we called you here. Master Skywalker, you have a certain contact that we need you to cultivate."
"What sort of contact?"
"An old one. A personal one. I might even say, a romantic one."
"Wait a minute. I don't know what you're getting at, but there's a lady of your acquaintance," Captain Showalter said, "by the name of Gariel Captison, out in the Bakuran system. She seems to have a battle fleet in her possession. We were hoping you might ask her if you could borrow it." The X-TIE fighter lumbered along through hyperspace, and Lieutenant Belindi Kalenda of New Republic Intelligence knew she should be grateful for even that much performance. The X-TIE was an ugly, a chop job made up of salvaged parts of an X-Wing and an early model TIE fighter. As far as Kalenda could tell, it combined all the worst handling characteristics of the two old adversaries with maybe a few of its own nasty surprises thrown in. But say what else you might, the thing had gotten her this far. Given the way the flight had started, with her stealing the ship on Corellia while Han Solo provided a diversion by blowing up what seemed like half the spaceport, it was a miracle she had a ship at all. By all rights, she should have crashed or been shot down 30 seconds after launch. But none of that mattered now. She was on her way to Coruscant, nearly there, in fact. And she had information no one outside the Corellian system was likely to have. She had to get through. Nothing else mattered. Belindy Kalenda was a slightly odd-looking young woman, even at the best of times, and she had not been at her best in a long time. Her eyes were set a bit wide apart, and they were a trifle glassy. It was disconcerting to many people, giving them the feeling that she was looking not at them, but past them. That was not too far wrong, in fact. She had never worked to develop it, but Kalenda had long felt she had just the slightest skill in the Force. Just enough to give her a warning now and then, make her intuitions a bit stronger and more reliable. Unfortunately, all her intuition was telling her at the moment was what she would have known anyway. She was in over her head. The survival of who knew how many planets, how many intelligent beings had been dumped in her lap. Aside from being responsible for the fate of millions, she had the task of jollying this monstrosity of a spacecraft long enough to get her to Coruscant. Of course, there was the question of what sort of reception she would receive there. She knew how suspicious the New Republic Navy was of unknown ship types. It would be understandable if they blasted her out of the sky first and asked questions later. The Lady Luck lifted off from Coruscant with a smooth surge of power and moved gracefully toward orbit. Lando checked his instruments.
Everything in the green.
He checked the central repeater boards.
R2's got your X-wing right in the groove behind us.
It had taken some fairly ingenious improvised engineering to allow the X-wing to hook up with the Lady Luck, but now that it was done, the X-wing could fly up under the base of the Lady and dock itself to the space yacht's newly installed ventral docking clamps.
Yes, sir, Lando said. Next stop, Bakura.
Yes, said Luke. Bakura. Bakura and Gariel Captison. Luke had not so much as heard her name in years, but the thought of her had not lost its power to move him. He had met Gariel in the tumultuous days just after the destruction of the second Death Star and the deaths of Darth Vader and the Emperor. Her planet, Bakura, had been attacked by a then-unknown alien species, the Siruk, that was intent on enslaving humanity. Imperial and Republic forces had joined together to push the Siruk back, and the Bakurans had kept a close watch on their borders ever since. Luke and Gariel had gotten to know each other very well in a very short period of time, and then had been forced to part just as quickly. It would have been a gross exaggeration to say she had been one of the great loves of his life, or indeed a love at all, but she might have been. That was what gnawed at him. Luke sighed and rubbed his eyes.
It was a long time ago, Lando said gently. Life moves on.
Quite right, Master Luke, 3PO piped up. It is approximately 14 standard years since you have had any contact with her.
Luke, would it really bother you that much if I put just a few blaster holes in him?
Luke managed a wan smile and glanced back at 3PO.
Don't be so hard on him, Lando. After all, he did save your life when you were about to marry the Life Witch on Laria Carousel.
Go ahead, 3PO. Tell me what you've got on Gariel.
Very good, Master Luke. She continued in politics after the Siruk were defeated and became a powerful figure in her faction of the Senate. After holding various posts of increasing importance, she became the youngest person ever to hold the post of Prime Minister on Bakura. Her party was defeated in the last election. Several press accounts attribute this to her being distracted from the campaign by the illness and death of her husband.
Husband? She had a husband?
Oh, yes, Master Luke. She married about 6 years ago to a man called Revklar Ospir. They had a child, a girl, whom they named Malinza. She is now 4.5 standard years old. Revklar contracted a lingering ailment with which I am not familiar, something called Knaut's disease. He contracted the disease just as the campaign was getting underway and expired 2 days after Gariel's party was defeated. It would seem that she is out of active politics, at least for the moment.
That large dose of news, old news, hit Luke hard. Strange to think that Gariel had gained and lost a husband, reached and fallen from the heights of power on her world, and given birth to a daughter, all without Luke knowing a thing about it. Somewhere in the back of his mind, he had held a picture of Gariel. He realized with a shock just how unchanging that image had been. In his mind's eye, she had stayed the effervescent young woman he had known, all the drive and enthusiasm of youth eternally hers, frozen in time. But he should have known better. Life was not like that. Luke felt he should say something, but he didn't know what. Somehow, he did not much want to explain his feelings to Lando, and certainly not to 3PO. I hadn't heard any news of her in a long time. I'm sorry to hear that her husband died.
Oh, but that was over a year ago, Master Luke. She is more than likely over it by now.
Somehow, Luke doubted that. The Gariel he remembered was not the type to marry on a whim. She would have married a man she loved very deeply. She might well have gotten on with her life by now, but she would not have gotten over her husband. And she had a child, a daughter. Luke undid his seatbelt. We'll talk later, 3PO. I think I could do with a bit of time to myself right now. Call me if you need me for anything. I'll be in my cabin. Amazing how a name from the past could affect someone.